In this episode, my guest and I will place the politics of 2023 in the perspective of history. Specifically, we'll peel the history behind the hyper-masculine politics of Trumpism. And we'll talk about this interesting word, polytainment.
Polytainment is a fascinating word that I wish I could claim I invented. All right. So in 1988, to use the phrase, he shocked America. Jesse Ventura was elected governor of Minnesota. No one expected it would happen. His politics reflects, I think, this almost blow to masculinity that many of his supporters have really faced, kind of tragically in the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years or so, you know, maybe 40 years, in the sense that they used to be the primary breadwinners. They had union scale jobs at, you know, that paid really good wages. Those jobs have disappeared. He says, don't worry, we're going to get Nixon. And you watch that and you think, oh my God, this is incredible. Okay. So now.
And Baker, it was a Republican, obviously.
It was a Republican. Republicans say we're going to get a Republican president because he's abusing his authority. The percentage of filibusters or threatened filibusters is way up. And the amount of legislation adopted by some measures takes us back to the 1940s in terms of the amount. And I say that because in the early 1940s, mid-1940s, the country's preoccupied with World War II. It's not doing a lot of legislating. There's this legendary story, takes us back to the 1980s, when Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, he's Democrat, and C-SPAN is first starting. And you would see these scenes where Republicans would get up and denounce the leadership. They would denounce Tip O'Neill or whatever it may be or something like that. And one day, to the anger of Republicans, he asked C-SPAN, move the cameras back to pan to see what it looks like. And it showed these members of the House speaking to an empty chamber. I think the election's down to roughly 100,000 or so voters next year that are going to decide the election.
Wow.
And then now we have new variables.
Do you appreciate how crazy that statement is? I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying it's just really crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah, it is crazy.
Did you know that the 10 richest men in America are worth more than the bottom 45% of Americans, which perhaps makes the most important underlying issue in this year's presidential election, the economic inequality, the widening gap between America's rich and poor. My guest has correctly projected every U.S. presidential election for more than two decades. So, as we're at the top of the year, an election year, I ask him this. Who's going to win? Hey there, News Peelers. Today is Wednesday, January 3rd. 2024. Happy New Year. This is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink or both, and let's get into it. How Mr. Mike Johnson ascended to the speakership of the United States of America's House of Representatives is a sort of crazy story that we would read about in history books, right? But it was just last year, and we all lived through it. Remember how it took 15 rounds to elect Mr. McCarthy, and how, after just 10 months, he was ousted? And then, Republicans couldn't elect a new speaker for weeks. This is the kind of chaos that happens in other countries, like in Italy, with its history of political instability and turmoil. So I asked my guest, Dr. David Schultz, who was teaching a class in Italy just a couple of months ago, what did Italians think about the chaos in our Congress? Dr. Schultz has a good idea of what Europeans think of America's chaotic politics, because he has taught in Europe. He even has faculty status in Lithuania's military academy in Vilnius, Lithuania. And in years prior, he was sent to Europe by the State Department to represent the United States as an independent scholar. He is a distinguished university professor in the departments of political science, environmental studies, and legal studies at Hamline University. He's also an adjunct professor of law at the University of Minnesota and at the University of St. Thomas. He's a four-time Fulbright scholar who has taught extensively in Europe and Asia, and the winner of the Leslie A. Whittington National Award for Excellence in Public Affairs Teaching. But that's not all. Dr. Schultz is the author of more than 200 articles and about 45 books on various aspects of American politics, election law, and the media and politics. In this episode, we talk about one of his books, which is titled Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Polytainment. By the way, in explaining the history of filibuster, Dr. Schultz mentions the film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's a movie I immediately recognized. I had watched it a long time ago. And in my excitement, I said that Cary Grant played the role of Mr. Smith. Well, that's not correct. I was wrong. As you probably know, it was Jimmy Stewart who played the role of Jefferson Smith, an idealistic young senator who fights government corruption. Don't you wish we had more of those? To learn more about Dr. Schultz, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Schultz and I peel the history behind this news. I'm excited to share with you the news that later this month we will launch Unraveling the Middle East. It's a whole new weekly podcast, a series on the Middle East, its in-depth history, and analysis. For example, one economic historian will answer this question: why Middle East economies and military technologies fell behind Europe? In another episode, a U.S. military historian will tell us how America's military interests and involvement started out in the Middle East and how it's evolved and whether or not it's paid off. I've dropped a link to Unraveling the Middle East in the detailed caption of this episode, so you can follow this program on your favorite podcast platform. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Schultz about America's 2023 politics in perspective of history. Dr. Schultz, it's a pleasure to have you on our program again. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. Let's briefly review some of the very public, unprecedented chaos in the U.S. Congress in 2023, particularly in the House.
Right.
What stood out for you?
Two things stood out to me. One of them is the constant churning over selecting initially a Speaker of the House way back, ancient history of January of 2023, and then the ouster of the Speaker of the House, and then the churning to select a new Speaker of the House. And in some sense, these are threads that connect each other by, what, roughly 10 months, is that the factors that led to McCarthy's rise and fall are the factors that led to the rise and fall of several candidates and eventually the selection of the new speaker. So that would stand out. The second thing that stands out to me, we can do more detail on both of them. Only the sixth time in American history, the House ousted a member from Congress.
Yeah.
Those are the two things that at a mega level that really, there's a lot of other stuff, but let's start with those.
I want to go to the ouster of Congressman Santos. You're not only a historian, but you also have experience with law, obviously ample experience. What do you think from a legal level? When I look at this, and this is not a political comment, this is a legal comment, sort of think like, well, should he not have some sort of legal proceeding determine the outcome of his, you know, guilt or innocence? And from a political perspective, when I think of it, is, well, what if members of Congress in another context gang up against another representative, and there are some charges, and even though that representative is duly voted in by the members of his or her own constituent, now they kick that member out. Does this trouble you?
Potentially it does, because let's think about where I am located. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, across the river from Minneapolis. There is a Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who has made lots of controversial statements about Israel, depending on your perspective, controversial statements about the Palestinians, but very sharply critical of U.S. foreign policy and support for Israel. Could there be a possibility that at some point a let us say, a Republican majority, she's a Democrat, by the way, a Republican majority is so incensed by her and says, they're going to oust her. They're going to oust her and say she's engaging in actions unbecoming a member of Congress and toss her out.
Even though her constituents may still want her there, right?
Correct. Yeah. She won by well in excess of 60% of the popular vote in the last election. She has one of the most secure Democratic seats, and I'll just say one of the most secure congressional seats in the country at this point. Yeah. So on one level, it does concern me. But on the other level, we have to think in a couple of different directions here. One of them is the fact that the Constitution, for good or for bad, does give to Congress the broad authority to determine the fitness and qualifications of its members. And there's something on one level that I'm happy about with the Santos decision, because they didn't wait for a criminal conviction. They said that our standard of conduct is not, have you been convicted of a crime? It is some higher ethical standard in terms of again, bringing disrepute to Congress. And if we're thinking in terms
of a higher standard.
A higher standard, yes. Yeah. If we're thinking in terms of saying, do we expect our elected officials merely to what, as I call it, skim the surface of the law to say, I haven't been convicted yet. I haven't done anything that a court of law has said wrong. I'm not sure with regular citizens or with members of Congress, I would consider that to be ethical behavior. So I'm pleased to see on one level that they did this. But remember, it's only the sixth person in the House of Representatives. The last time this happened was in the 1980s, I believe it was. It was Representative Traficant, who was actually convicted of a crime. This case with Santos, he's the first member ever not to have been convicted of a crime or not associated with expulsions surrounding the Civil War. Because after the Civil War, we had in 1860, when the South seceded from the Union, we had a large number of senators from the South and a fair number of House members from the South who went with the Confederacy and for obvious reasons they were expelled from Congress at this point. So this is an unusual move that does cut potentially a couple of ways.
But in this case, I do agree with you. Santos's case was just so egregious. But you see, my question was a bit academic, but it may have real political ramifications down the line. And the example that you brought up regarding Representative.
The other thing I should say that was good here, it was the Republican-led House that ousted one of their own Republicans. I would be even more concerned had this been a Democratic Party-controlled House that ousted him. I still think, based on everything I've read, Santos deserved to be ousted from Congress. But here, you can at least say that you didn't have the partisan dimension in the sense that this really is the Republicans policing themselves. And that you've got to give at least some bonus points to.
Of course, that's a positive precedent, actually.
I think that's wonderful. We really, we actually had bipartisan agreement here that his behavior was so egregious that he deserves to be ousted. Now, to me, my only concern is the fact that this should have probably happened earlier, but I can understand they went through, they had an ethics report that the House put together. They actually did some institutional due process. And once they reached their own conclusion that he had engaged in behavior that raised serious ethical issues, they moved relatively quickly to oust him.
Yeah. There are many different things and details and factors we can go into about Congress in 2023. What I'm wondering is, taking a grand view of Congress this past year and the chaos, is there another period in American history that resonates with this? I can think of the period before the Civil War, the period maybe in the 1870s. I don't know, maybe the 1920s during Prohibition. What are your thoughts on this? Have we had go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say is that for so many years, by the way, okay, so for many years, I give a lot of community talks and it's sort of funny. I can almost picture this. I'll give a community talk and somebody will start by coming to me and they'll be wringing their hands or pulling their hair saying, isn't it the most polarized we've ever been in American history? And I'll say, well, hell, the Civil War really beats the heck out of this. There is no comparison. But I have to say right now, we are starting to get to that point in terms of a comparison to the Civil War. Because, you know, even in, let's say, the 1920s, if we're really looking at a conflict that's going on, it's not within Congress, it is Congress and the courts, or the 1920s and the 1930s. The Supreme Court and Congress are viewing things differently. And it's really, I think, the churning that happens with the Civil War, the secession from the Union, we talked about it before, the expulsions, and then maybe post-Civil War, the Reconstruction. So we're really into an area now that's very unique. In my American politics class at Hamline University, where I teach, there's this wonderful little book that I use. It's called A Brief Introduction to American Political History by Donald Critchlow. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. I'm not selling the book. I have no royalties in this one. But one of the things that he wants to point out is how, you know, problems that we see today have antecedents throughout American history. Like we think that it's unique today that we have polarization or that we have party conflict. And he's saying, guess what? We've always had this. These are unresolved problems. But here it is unique. And if I look at some measures, I can point to some things that really put us, let's say, at least in the last half century, that make us unique. Mm-hmm. And if I were to go back, let's say approximately 50 years, let's say mid-70s at this point. And if we were to look at votes in Congress, first that we would find that the vast majority of the votes in Congress were bipartisan. And that's a good measure, at least for most of us, who would say. And unless we subscribe to the theory that the government that governs the least governs the best, and there are some who might say that, the productivity in Congress was actually quite good. A lot of bills were passed, a lot of critical legislation adopted bipartisanly, and there were very few filibusters.
By comparison, this sounds great.
Sounds great. It was a great period, actually, in American history. Remember, Republicans and Democrats got together to oust Nixon. I still remember this scene. There's this scene I saw in a video recently of Senator Howard Baker, who's a Republican in the Senate. And I can't remember what talk show he was back on in the 70s. And one of the talk show hosts is, again, practically frenetic, saying, Nixon's going to get away with it. Nixon's going to get away with it. And Howard Baker, Republican senator from Tennessee, pats this person's hand and says, don't worry, we're going to get Nixon. And you watch that and you think, oh my God, this is incredible. Okay. So now.
And Baker, it was a Republican, obviously.
It was a Republican. Republican saying we're going to get a Republican president because he's abusing his authority. Now get us to the last, let's say, 3 to 4 years. The percentage of legislation that's bipartisan is very low. The vast majority is straight party line. That means one party's voting for it, essentially no minority party voting for it. The percentage of filibusters or threatened filibusters is way up. And the amount of legislation adopted by some measures takes us back to the 1940s in terms of the amount. And I say that because in the early 1940s, mid-1940s, the country's preoccupied with World War II. It's not doing a lot of legislating.
Yeah.
It's outside of what? Allocating money for the armies at this point. So, or another way of looking at it is that in the 1970s, again, by measuring votes, we could see an ideological overlap between the Democrats and Republicans. Now, in voting behavior, the most liberal voting Republicans, his or her record, is still more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. There's no ideological overlap between the parties.
Wow. We're going to talk more about politics of populism and Trump in the subsequent segments. But before we go there, I had a comment to make and a question to ask. My comment, subject to your sort of correction, confirmation, is that you mentioned filibuster several times. As I see it, going back to history, filibusters have become much easier. Before, you had the speaking filibusters where you had to be on the floor. You had to be there sometimes 2-3 days. It was famous, the Southern senators, when they filibustered in the civil rights movement, they were literally there. But now it's not like that anymore. Now you sort of announce it and you don't have to be on the Senate well anymore, right?
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. The image that most people have, if you Google an old movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
That's right. That's
right.
Yeah.
And you have
Cary Grant. Yeah.
I think it's Cary Grant, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And he's been talking so long, he's hoarse. He can't even get his voice out anymore. And that was pretty accurate. In the old days, you couldn't take bathroom breaks or anything like that. Yeah. And so there's we won't go into the legendary stories about what people wore during the filibuster, but you're right. You physically had to be there. And also another thing you couldn't do, you couldn't lean on something. You couldn't prop yourself up by, let's say, putting your hand on a table or something. You had to be fully erect, standing up doing the filibuster. Now you merely have to threaten and say, I'm going to filibuster it. And that acts as a way of basically stopping the debate on that legislation. Now, the old-fashioned filibusters stopped everything, though. They stopped all the movement on the floor for legislating. On one level, these filibusters now are a little bit more narrow, but still.
Explain that. I don't appreciate the difference. What do you mean they're more narrow?
Okay. The old filibusters would stop all the work in the Senate.
Okay.
Everything. Now you can filibuster a particular piece of legislation.
Oh, so sort of like a topic-based, subject-based filibuster.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. I did not appreciate that difference. And what are the things from a political perspective? I mean, you explained the physical strain on the filibustering senator, but from a political perspective, people would, well, back then, newspapers, they would read about it, I guess, more than see you on TV. But you had to politically put yourself out there by essentially stopping everything that the Senate does. Now, the political costs of filibusters are arguably a little bit less because you're not in front of people on C-SPAN for 3 days stopping the nation's business.
You're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Although, we'll tell a kind of a funny story, though, about one filibuster a few years ago. And I can't even remember what the topic was, but Senator Ted Cruz from Texas decided to filibuster, and he actually decided to do a real filibuster.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is really quite rare to actually. So, and it's on C-SPAN, by the way, and it got to be evening, and he generally reads his children a bedtime story, you know, before they go to bed, like many parents. And so So part of his filibuster was reading Green Eggs and Ham from the floor of the House of Representatives. And whatever you may think of Ted Cruz, good, bad, ugly, in between, it was kind of humorous to watch because some of the old filibusters, they would do things like that. They would read from the Bible or they would read the Constitution.
Or a cookbook.
Yeah. You didn't actually have to keep talking about the legislation as long as you kept talking or something like that. So America heard Green Eggs and Ham.
I love it at a
young child's bedtime.
I will have to Google that, go on YouTube. One final question here. I told you I have a comment and a question. So here's the question. We were talking about Santos, and we talked about the sort of the legislative due process he had with the Ethics Committee, and then you mentioned the standard of conduct.
Right.
We expect our legislatures, national legislatures, to have a higher standard of sort of ethics than being merely not being criminals. So let's talk about decorum and statesmanship. It seems to be fading, at least in the House of Representatives. Right. Is it a case that we have always had it and now we're losing it? Or is it the case that it's been the same? It's just that in the past, we had stronger leaders in Congress who prevented crazy representatives or senators from doing crazy stuff. Yeah, what do you think?
I mean, we obviously have had some crazy things happen throughout American history.
We've
had an occasional, but very, very rare fist fights or altercations, you know, in the House of Representatives. But these, these are incredibly rare situations.
Yeah.
But you're generally right. It's a combination of the fact that the leadership was much stronger, and if I can use the word, sat on members, and basically, sort of, you're not going to do certain things. But there also was the sense in which, for a lot of the members, was that greater respect for decorum. But I think one of the things that has changed, both positive and negative, is the broadcasting of Congress. Good in the sense good in the sense that we get to see them doing the people's business, and that's good. That's really, really good. But on the other hand, I think there's more hamming to the camera. There's much more playing to the camera at this point. And some of this, I wonder now how much of it is that. There's this legendary story, takes us back to the 1980s, when Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, he's Democrat, and C-SPAN is first starting. And you would see these scenes where Republicans would get up and denounce the leadership. They would denounce Tip O'Neill or whatever it may be or something like that. And one day, to the anger of Republicans, he asked C-SPAN, move the cameras back to pan to see what it looks like. And it showed these members of the House speaking to an empty chamber. And what we're wondering now, again, how much now do we see people like, I don't know, we can range anywhere from Laura Bobet, Marjorie Taylor Greene, to Matt Gaetz, to maybe a host of others at this point. I don't want to quite say, is this their Andy Warhol, you know, 15 minutes of fame? But there is a little bit of that 15 minutes of fame there. And have to say that there are Democrats who do the same thing. I think Charles Schumer oftentimes has a very good sense of how to speak to the camera to get the reports. And so it's a bipartisan learning about how to use the camera.
Yeah. And another difference is that after you're done with that take, now that gets reposted and reposted and reposted and reposted on social media. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the hyper-masculine politics of Trumpism and why Taylor Swift is right about politics. We'll be right back. As the 2024 presidential election is fast approaching, you should probably have this in mind if you're on the fence about donating to your favorite candidate. There are only about 200 individuals whose political donations really matter when it comes to U.S. elections. By the way, I don't say this to dissuade or discourage you from donating, as if as if your donation to your political causes or political candidates don't matter. No, I hope it fires you up to donate, to get involved. Anyway, I learned of this when I spoke with Dr. Schultz after the 2022 midterm elections. Remember how the red wave that was trumped up to be a red tsunami never happened? I've dropped the link for you to my conversation with Dr. Schultz in Season 2, Episode 39, in which he spoke with me about America's elections and explained why he believes that the highly polarized politics that we suffer from now may actually subside in a decade or so. And that's good news, right? Now, let's get back to our current conversation with Dr. Schultz about America's chaotic politics in 2023. Dr. Schultz, in your book, which is titled Trumpism, American Politics in the Age of Polytainment, which you shared with me, and thank you so much for that, and I read it cover to cover, you talk about the hyper-masculine nature of Trumpism. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of sources to what we would call Trumpism, you know. But part of it is about the fact that if you look at a lot of his core base are white working class, especially males, and in general, it's a much more masculine base than a female base than it is in terms of who's voting for him. And part of what I argue is that his politics reflects, I think, this almost blow to masculinity that many of his supporters have really faced, kind of tragically, in the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years or so, you know, maybe 40 years, in the sense that they used to be the primary breadwinners. They had union scale jobs at, you know, that paid really good wages. Those jobs have disappeared. They're no longer in a society where we have really clearly defined roles of which they were comfortable in. And what Trump speaks to is the frustration, the anger that many of these individuals face. And without sort of doing pop psychology here a little bit, there is a sense in which his bravado, his way of approaching politics really speaks to what a lot of these individuals would like to say, but maybe feel like they can't really say anymore because circumstances have changed in their society or their life.
Oh, that's fascinating.
He is their spokesperson. He says what they want to say.
So many of these men are no longer the king of their castles, not the sole monarchs anymore. Many of them, their spouses are also bringing in income, sometimes even higher than them, more income than them. And this may be a frustration in the last 20, 30 years.
It is for people who were raised from a different generation where they were still raised with the idea of the very traditional sex roles in our society, that the male is the breadwinner. He's supposed to be kind of the protector of the family. And the reason why I think this is important, I know for many people, they'll say, well, they're not sympathetic to these individuals. I have some sympathy for them because the plight that they're facing speaks something about the changing fortunes of America. And again, I think of my father who passed away many years ago, who was working class, never went to college, actually never even went to high school, but managed to get a good job, in a union, and was able to provide for the family. Those jobs at the auto plants, at the steel mills, manufacturing. This was the core of America. And we've lost all that. And for many of these men who they have become what? I hate to use the phrase the losers in the new economy, but they've become the losers in the new economy. And we've done very little to address their economic fortunes and needs. And
which is real.
Which is real. It's absolutely real. And one of the other ways that it manifests itself out is the fact that the opioid crisis in America falls disproportionately hard in the areas that vote for Donald Trump. I mean, we could do almost a perfect map. If I were to get a map of all the counties in the United States and color them in there in terms of which counties voted for Trump versus didn't, and then fill those same counties in with a map in terms of the highest incidences of overdose, opioid overdose in America, the correlations are stark in terms of the overlap.
Oh boy. So as you talk about this, this hyper-masculine nature of Trumpism, even if we take the word Trumpism, this issue has got to reverberate through Congress because many of the members of Congress represent these people.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely correct. And one of the few things we're seeing a little of bipartisan agreement on, but still not a lot, for example, is on the issue of let's say, opioid problems and opioid addiction. Although we're still not putting the resources we need into that. We're still not putting the resources into, let us say, mental health. But what we're not really addressing is that underlying economic inequality. You know, that I did a piece recently about 3 or 4 months ago. And every year, Forbes magazine lists like the richest people in the world. I totaled up the 10 richest individuals in America, the 10 richest men. They're worth $1 trillion. That's their net worth.
Wow.
The bottom 45% of America does not have a net worth of $1 trillion.
Bottom 45%?
The bottom 45% does
Holy
not.
Holy moly.
And someone said to me, is there any relationship with there being so many few rich people and so many poor people? And I said, yeah, there is a relationship between the two.
Yeah.
And we unfortunately have one of the worst gaps between the rich and poor ever in American history. Unfortunately, our social mobility has largely ground to a halt. And what I'm getting at here is that we need to address the underlying economic problems that I think are driving part of Trumpism also, which is it is the fact that we've got these huge inequalities that are threatening, I think, the family structure, the mental health, our political system. And that's where we have almost no agreement in Congress on what to do.
Did we see any display of this hyper-masculinity in Congress this year? In a way, much of it was the lack of negotiations, playing chicken. Would you put those in that category?
I would. I would also put the fact that again, the confrontational politics, close to a shutdown again. I would say the confrontational politics over selecting a Speaker of the House. I would even say to some extent, you know, as we are taping this show in early December, Speaker Johnson has said, we're just about getting ready to proceed with perhaps impeachment hearings or impeachment investigations for Biden. It is all about confrontational, in-your-face politics now. And I think a lot of that really is driven by the hyper-masculinity that we find in American politics now. And if I can sort of bring it to a personal kind of a note here, too, in a way.
All right.
Is that I do a lot of interviews, media, local, community talks, and so forth. And a generation ago, if people wanted to contact me, and they disagreed with me or something, it was a very respectful, dear professor so-and-so, I heard you, I don't agree. And it would be a very nice, respectful kind of, you know, exchange. Now when I do hear from people, it's, you know, it's incredibly insulting. It's threatening. The way I describe it, it starts off with someone almost thinking that my mother should have been prosecuted for giving birth to me. And then it goes down from there. But I've actually had to call the police twice because, my phone at work records the number. And I had people threatening me and I had to call police. And so it's not just Congress. It's a much more confrontational I think, society than we've had before. And I just see it in terms of how people contact me and how they approach me, even though I don't know who these people are.
As you were sharing your personal story, I chuckled a couple of times because it's funny, but in a way, it's massively tragic that this would happen to anyone for just something you said.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm commenting on something or I'm trying to describe something.
Yeah.
And remember the old phrase, don't shoot the messenger? Well, in some sense, messengers are being, if I can say that, are being shot at this point. And everybody disagrees with you. And it's okay to disagree. And I've made mistakes too. And I'm more than happy to acknowledge them. But just again, just the push, the way it's happened. And I've really seen this start since about 2010. So it's about 13, 14 years where we started to see this real shift in terms of our culture. And maybe that's sort of the time where we start to see the hypermasculinity of Trumpism, its roots start to emerge.
In your book, Trumpism, American Politics and the Age of Polytainment, you have 10 rules. One, rule number three, I'll just read it for you, says, Taylor Swift is right, and you talk about anger. I was so intrigued by that I asked my daughter to go find me any Taylor Swift song that has politics in it, and she did. So I'll just share a couple of lines from Miss Swift's song, Antihero. It goes as such, did you hear my covert narcissism I disguise as altruism like some kind of congressman? So I get that line. It's about narcissism. I don't know how you correlate Taylor Swift with anger, and then that goes to politics. Explain that, please.
Okay, so here, let me tell you a little bit about the book also. So when I wrote the book, I had a lot of pop, because I wanted to sort of distill American politics down to about 10 rules and do it in kind of a way that references pop culture to make it accessible to the general public. Well, we have to confess, I'm a baby boomer, you know, and my pop culture references would be dated for many people. And I gave a talk to a local high school several years ago. And as oftentimes I do, I end my talk to the high school students by saying, and if anybody wants to do a follow-up, contact me. And no one ever does. But this time, a delightful young woman named Avery called me. And she said, I heard your talk and it was really interesting. I'm going to go to college at some point. I don't know. And I'm thinking of majoring in political science, but I'm not sure. Can I shadow you? Basically, sort of like, you know, see what you do as a political scientist. And I said, sure. And I told her about the book and she read it and she said, or a draft of it. She said, great. But she said, it's nobody of my generation can relate to any of your examples. And I said, so give me some examples here. And my original reference there was to Rod Stewart, a great rock and roller.
I love Rod Stewart. Yeah.
And he had a wonderful song called Passion. That's about passion. Great song. And she said to me, who's Rod Stewart? And I said, okay, so now I know I got a problem. So I said, who writes about passion or anger or in politics? And she goes, Taylor Swift, of course. She says all her songs are all about, in some sense, anger and passion and how she's turning it to politics. And she pointed out and said, and now Taylor Swift is out trying to get her supporters to vote. So I said, what a perfect addition to the book. So Avery becomes my co-author, which I'm so delighted for, but she brought in such wonderful pop culture references that I would just never have thought of.
Oh, that's a great story. And so you think that anger rather than, well, you mentioned confrontational politics. So your position is that anger rather than optimism is what is driving our political discourse these days.
I think it is. Yeah. I mean, if we think of 2008, it was all about Barack Obama running on hope and change. And that's the optimism. Or take us back a generation before that. It's Bill Clinton, you know, which I still, and I reference in my book, that has a brilliant move. When he gets the nomination, he's a baby boom candidate, and he plays at his at his at the Democratic National Convention, Fleetwood Mac's "Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow."
That's a good one.
Future. And then, and a decade before, Ronald Reagan in 1984, one of the great political commercials of all time. It was, "It's Morning in America."
Isn't that a great visually? Is great.
I mean, these are gorgeous themes.
Yeah.
But now, it's really about, it really became anger at this point. And even though Trump in 16 said, "Make America Great Again," there's a bit of optimism, but it's also a retrospective. It's saying, let's go back to the days that used to be so that we can be great again. And in it, there is this distillation of anger, of something lost, of expectations that have been thwarted that we used to have. And I see now that our candidates run upon anger, getting their base angry, getting their base motivated to hate the other side. That's the change. That's the change in American politics.
Yeah, and it's a big one. We'll be back after a short break to talk about politics, populism, and entertainment. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Schultz, what is polytainment, which is a part of the title of your book?
Okay, polytainment is a fascinating word that I wish I could claim I invented. All right, so in 1988, to use the phrase, he shocked America. Jesse Ventura was elected governor of Minnesota. No one expected it would happen. And I was teaching a class in 1999 at Hamlin, my very first year there. And one of my students wrote a paper and said that Jesse Ventura was the most recent example of a line of polytainers, a politician combined with an entertainer, and that we were into a new era of polytainment. And what she wanted to talk about is how politics and entertainment, how pop culture and politics had merged together. And her examples over time were just wonderful, great examples about how at one point in the 1960s, to take us way back, Richard Nixon was running for president, and he appeared in 1968 on a television show called Laugh-In, the number one rated show in America at that point, to do a small comedy routine. Or Ronald Reagan, the ultimate polytainer, an actor who knew to deliver lines on camera so well. Or one of the most famous scenes is in 1992 when Bill Clinton appears on the then Arsenio Hall show, dons glasses and a saxophone and plays the Heartbreak Hotel. And what she said is that pop culture has always been a little bit part of politics, but now it was fused. She thought with Jesse Ventura, we had really gotten to that point. And if I now could bring it up to the present, I argued that Donald Trump is the ultimate polytainer. For how many years was he the host of Apprentice? With his signature line, "You're fired." How he was the ultimate marketer on a whole range of products. I mean, Trump was a brand, and Trump ran for president as a brand when you think about it. And so to me, politics is about branding, about that merger. And there's lots of ways of thinking about it. It's about how the media, especially the news establishment, thrives upon polytainment type of candidates like Donald Trump. Think about for the Trump presidency, every morning he would start off on Twitter with two or three messages that would then dictate this news cycle for the day. So in some sense, there was a symbiotic relationship. When Trump was running for president in 2016, there are stories that the media gave Trump several billion dollars in free media coverage because it found that anytime it talked about Trump, the ratings went up. So that's the concept. How do we think about American politics in an age when politics and entertainment are fused together?
Isn't that dangerous?
It's incredibly dangerous. It really is. Because in one of the books I did on the media many years ago, I said that if we think of the core purpose of what the media, and actually I'm going to refine it, what the news establishment is supposed to be, we give it First Amendment protection, freedom of the press, because the press is supposed to provide what I call the democratic function, provide us with the vital information that we need to make informed decisions as citizens and to serve as a watchdog over the government. As I describe it, the job of the media is to bark and to bite. You know, the government does something right or wrong or whatever, like a watchdog, bark and bite. And if now the media is all about profit making,
yeah,
if it's all about entertainment, it's lost that function. In an article I did many years ago, I make this reference. There's a point when Bill Clinton is running for president in 92, and there are rumors of infidelity even at that point. The National Enquirer, which most of us don't hold up as to be one of the great newspapers in America.
Standards of journalism, right?
That's right, Brad. Did a story all about alleged extramarital affairs. The New York Times ran that article from the National Enquirer on the front page. And I think I wrote something in one of an article that said, suddenly all the news that fits the print meets what inquiring minds want to know. Slogans for the two newspapers. And that's really what's happened now, is that the press has turned into the media. And there's a big difference there, because the media, it's not about reporting the news. It's about profit maximization.
Let me approach this issue from a different angle. Do you think polytainment, this immediate access of most of our politicians via social media or other means to their constituents, or at times even all Americans, do you think it has also reduced the quality of communication and his sort of descended our politicians from, I don't know, an elevated status? The reason I ask this question is because in the past, presidents and even some senators would write something or would think something, their staff would write it, they would think about it, then they would publish it. Right. But now, as you said, you could be sitting, pardon me, on the toilet and just literally tweet to the entire world, like Trump used to do.
Yeah. I mean, in general, there's the argument that says that the social media has produced less deliberation.
Yeah.
Some of us have told the joke that's saying that there ought to be a 20-minute delay on the send feature on our computers or on our cell phones at this point, so that we take
time. I'm all for that. It's a great thing.
I think it's a great idea to think about it, because we send things in haste, we send things in anger, we don't deliberate. And you're right, there is a sense in which we've lost that deliberative capacity, you know, that is so important to democracy at this point. And I think that's important. I mean, I think if I think of the things that we've lost, one is the deliberative nature. And I'm also going to invoke one of my professors. I did my master's in political science at Rutgers University. Ben Barber was one of my teachers, a wonderful, wonderful person. And he wrote a book called Strong Democracy. And what he said, we have a lot of noise in our democracy. A lot of people are talking, which he said is good, but very few people are listening. Hmm. And I thought, that's really interesting. And his argument was to say, too much talk, too quickly without thinking about it, but too little opportunity and too little time spent on listening. And we've lost that dialogue, that deliberative dialogue in American politics. And I think now we just don't have that. We just don't have that in terms of a lot of our politicians, because they can be so instantaneously accessible through Twitter, through text messaging, that it's both non-deliberative and maybe canned at the same time. And what I mean by canned, it's market-driven or marketing-driven in terms of what they're sending out.
You want to say something, you don't want to wait too long, you want to be in the forefront, make sure your political opponents are not beating you to the punch. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Schultz as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Schultz, you were recently teaching in Europe, and you and I communicated while you were there. What I'm wondering is, did Europeans speak with you about what's happening in our Congress, particularly in the House of Representatives?
Yeah, they did. They did. And what's interesting is that people in Europe follow what's happening in America far more intently than people in America follow what's happening in Europe.
Yes.
Because we're still supposed to be the world leader. We're supposed to be the place that is the role model, the show model. And we are also in Europe because of our prominent role in NATO. You know, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, we are the primary guardian of European defense and security. And it was interesting, the comments that I was getting. You know, one of them, of course, there was just the dysfunctionalism in Congress that does not make us look good. And I was in Italy, and without making any type of, you know, ethnic jokes here, Italy has not been known for its most for having the most stable politics over time.
That's an understatement, Dr. Schultz. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking, what is the number? It's something like, I can't remember how many different governments they've had since World War II. It's a phenomenal number. And they looked at us and I was there during the time we were going through one of the speakers' fights, and they said to me, "You make us look stable by comparison." But the bigger concern was when I was in Lithuania, and I have faculty status at the Lithuanian Military Academy. So I'm talking to people who are concerned with European security issues. Lithuania borders on Russia, and what they were concerned about is how the dysfunction in American politics plays out in terms of perhaps a European, if not a global, security threat. Obviously, they're concerned about the funding for Ukraine for the war, but they're also concerned about the fact that at a point of turmoil, if we are distracted internally, are we going to be prepared? Again, I was in Lithuania when someone said, "What if Russian tanks roll across our border? And we have a NATO defense treaty. You're supposed to defend us, help us." They were wondering, are we going to be there? And so for them, this made me think about that issue, is that this is not just a question of congressional dysfunction. It is a question of American national security, and I would argue global security. And that was brought home. And when I was also in Slovakia, which borders on Ukraine, I was also in Romania, which is borders on Ukraine, at the schools that I was at, I heard the exact same message.
Those questions, when you're talking about security, when it comes from those schools, professors in those countries, first of all, the question is kind of personal. Is it like, are you guys with it? Do you have it all together? What's going to happen with us? And also, it's kind of there. It's a serious question. There's nothing funny about it. You know, let's say we poke fun of our Congress, but that's a serious question. What did you explain to them about what's happening? Well, were their questions rhetorical? Did they, or no, did they really?
No, these were serious questions. Okay. Yeah. So I'm sitting at the military academy, sitting around a table of which some of the faculty are civilian. But I'm sitting there with the head of the military academy, who's a brigadier general. I mean, I've got like serious military people sitting there, you know, with more brass hanging from their chest, you know, than I can think of. And they're asking deadly serious questions to me about issues of what does this mean? At one point they said, what if now China exploits this dysfunction in Congress and they start to go into Taiwan?
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Or I'm there when the Hamas Gaza Israeli matter is flaring up and they're like, all right, how is this going to distract the United States from the commitments that we have in that the US has to our country? So they're very, very serious about these issues, what's happening in Congress, and they are intensely following the 2024 presidential election.
Wow. First of all, so that I don't misinterpret what you were saying, you were not there as a representative of the United States. You were there as a scholar capacity, right? They were just trying to understand, right?
Correct. Absolutely correct. I am not there in my represent. I was not there representing the United States. Now, in the past, I have represented the United States in the past. For example, in 2008, I was sent by the U.S. State Department across the three Baltic states in Finland as an independent scholar, but to represent the United States to talk about American politics. So on some occasions, I am serving in a quasi-representative capacity. This situation here across Europe for this trip, I was in my individual scholar capacity.
When you represent the United States, even though as a scholar, are you at liberty to say what you think, or are there some constraints on the level?
Yeah, no, I am. I mean, part of what I'm supposed to be is the role model for the United States. And what I mean by that is that it is my job to emulate freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, and so forth like that. And what I mean by that is that I am free to say what I want. I will be honest and say, though, I certainly have to understand, you know, that there are certain constraints, you know, that I face. Like I will not go abroad and openly criticize, you know, the United States, you know, and I certainly won't act in a partisan capacity. That's not me anyhow, in terms of doing that. So there are some implicit norms when you operate in that capacity.
Yeah, and that's understood. You said in your visits, for example, in Latvia, in Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, that many scholars and military personnel are intensely interested in the 2024 election, which takes me to my last question of our conversation. You have correctly projected every U.S. presidential election, as well as many other national elections, for more than two decades now. So what do you think of 2024?
2024 is going to be it's always easy to say the most unique election in American history, but we're dealing with an incredibly unprecedented situation here where we've got a former president and a president running against one another. We've got a former president with facing 91 criminal charges with four broad indictments. We have 60% of the American public that does not like either of the candidates. We've got so many variables out there right now. Now, I did a piece recently that said that, remember, polls are not predictors. They're snapshots in time. We're over a year out from the election. But if the election were held roughly about now, the election's down to about five states that really matter, the five swing states. But if you total it all up, right now, Donald Trump is probably ahead in the Electoral College.
Wow.
But there are polls that indicate among swing voters, a criminal conviction could change the game for some of them. Because we're really down to what? As I say, it's a handful of swing voters in a few swing counties in five swing states that decide the election. I think the election's down to roughly 100,000 or so voters
next really?
Year that are going to decide the election.
Wow.
And then now we have new variables.
Do you appreciate how crazy that statement is? I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying it's just really crazy.
It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah, it is crazy. Now we have new variables out there. We've got, and it's a whole nother show for another day. We've got a guy named Robert Kennedy Jr. polling 20% in the polls. And yeah, as we speak, Liz Cheney is thinking of entering the presidential race as an independent. And if that were to happen, we have an incredible set of variables that we haven't seen in a long time. So this is a complex one for me right now. You know, back to me in a few more months when a few things settle. I can have a better picture. But this is a hard one to predict
for
right
sure,
now.
For sure, for sure. I wanted to make a historical comment here and get your take. As far as a former president running against a sitting president. I mean, again,
right.
That has happened before. Cleveland.
Right.
This happened with Cleveland.
Correct.
And Harrison. The difference is the sort of a rancid politics and populism,
right.
The criminal charges and what have you. In fact, Cleveland, in the interim 4 years that he was not president and ran against Harrison again, was sort of a model of bringing politics together and. So that part is really different. Do you see vengeance as I don't know, as a platform in 2024?
Yeah, let's come back to Taylor Swift. It's about anger. Anger,
yeah.
Vengeance. It's still all about emotion. Politics is about emotion. And there are good emotions and there are bad emotions. Anger and vengeance or revenge, I think, is what's driving part of this campaign for Trump.
And that's unfortunate. Dr. Scholz, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Talk to you later.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research. And we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.